Greetings and welcome back to our ongoing series on the Book of Esther, Megillat Esther. In this podcast, we're going to be studying the relatively short but very dynamic and significant Chapter 7, Perek Zion, which takes place at the second banquet immediately after Haman has been rushed to the banquet after returning home from the humiliating experience of leading Mordechai in king's garb on the king's horse through the streets of Shushan. And as I mentioned in the previous podcast, almost assuredly feeling like this is the one safe haven that he has, the one refuge where he is surrounded by friends as opposed to jeering members of the citizenry of Shushan, possibly, and I told you so's at home, which we hear in the last verse of chapter 6. V'avo melech v'amal ishtot im Esther hamalka. And pasuk bed is a repetition. V'ayom ha'melech l'Esther gam b'yom ha'sheni b'mishteh hayayin. The king said to Esther on the second day at the banquet, Ma she'elatech Esther hamalka v'tinat ten lach u'ma b'kashtech ad chatzi ha'machut v'te'as. This is the third time that we have heard this offer, and you can almost sense the exasperation in Ahasuerus's voice, finally wanting to know what it is that Esther wants, going back a day and a half to her first surprised and unsummoned appearance at his throne room. Now we have to remember that Esther is utilizing all of her wits to plant seeds, as I mentioned, of paranoia, which have now blossomed in Ahasuerus's mind towards Mordechai, towards Haman, and to pump up Haman's ego, which of course was successful until he crashed into Mordechai coming out of the first party. There is another piece to the puzzle that I did not yet mention, and that is that Esther has already utilized mystery as a successful weapon, not against, but sort of towards Ahasuerus. During the entire time that she's been in the palace, as far as we know, she has not identified herself, not by personal association, not by family association. Nobody knows who she is, the mystery woman. And that mystery, looking back in chapter 2, seemed to serve her well and make her more attractive and interesting to Ahasuerus. She has utilized that ploy and that bit of attraction and mystery here in this very critical national crisis by leading Ahasuerus on, not telling him right away what it is she wants, bring him to another party, and let him build up the suspense and the concern. And this is the third time the question has been asked. Vatomar evatan Esther hamalka vatomar. And she answered and said, Im matzati chen benach hamelach v'mal hamelach tov, protocol again, if I find favor in the eyes of the king, and if the king finds it good, and are waiting, if Ahasuerus are waiting, she wants either another banquet, or she wants another palace built, or she wants the head of her enemy, or who knows what she wants. He's waiting. What she says has got to be possibly the most surprising thing that he could have heard. Tinaten li nafshi b'she'elati v'ami b'vakashati. Let me have my life as my request, and my nation as what I'm asking. In other words, what she says is, spare me and spare my nation. The first thing that's surprising Ahasuerus is that instead of Esther coming with a demand of something she wants more of, she's asking for her life to be spared, which means somebody's threatening the life of the queen. Second thing is that Esther identifies herself as a member of a nation, which she did not know about yet, and she's got a nation that has been singled out as a threat. Now, you're Ahasuerus, you've got no idea what's going on, even though you allowed a particular unnamed nation to be singled out for some sort of a consequence and some sort of a change in status a few days ago. But you have no idea that this connects with Esther. If you're Haman, you've really got no idea. You figure it's some guy in the court, some group out there is threatening, they found out who her people is and they're threatening her, and it has nothing to do with you. And then she starts throwing out little hints. Kinimkarnu ani v'ami. We have been sold. I and my nation have been sold. Again, I and my nation, identifying them separately, I and my nation have been sold. Lahashmid, laharog, ule'abed. And she uses those same three words that appear in the documents sent out by Haman, but she throws out the word nimkarnu. Now, truth to tell, in many of the books of Tanakh, the notion of being having your life be forfeit is presented as a sale. For instance, at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, God sells the Jewish people into the hands of Yavin Melech Kanan in Perek Dalet. Vayim Kirem Biyad Yavin Melech Kanan. And so we see that handing a nation over so that the oppressing nation may do what they want is sort of idiomatically presented as Vayim Kirem. But nonetheless, there are other ways to say this. Right? Nimsarnu. And Nitanu. We've been given over for genocide. Instead, she says Nimkarnu. Why? I think that she's throwing out a hint there. Remember Achashverosh about that faux sale, the presumed 10,000 pieces of silver? And she throws out the same words and that keyword, la'abed, ve'ilu la'avadim v'lishfachod nimkarnu hecharashti. And then she says something that is absolutely bizarre. Imagine for a moment that a private citizen would call a law enforcement agency and report a violent crime going on down the block. And then, as an addendum, say, and by the way, if it was only a mugging, I wouldn't have called you. And that may be true, but it's a ridiculous statement to make. For Esther to say, we've been sold to be destroyed, genocide, and if we had only been sold as slaves, I wouldn't have said anything because it's not worth raising the, there's no gain to the king. In some sense, Eretz Hashemem and Nizek HaMelech is a very difficult phrase, but somehow it means it wouldn't be worth it. I wouldn't have said anything if we were only sold as slaves. Why is she mentioning that? She's mentioning it very clearly because she's throwing out the hint to Achashverosh that he thought they were being sold as slaves. And were that really true, she wouldn't have said anything. And that's why she uses the word sale. She's throwing up to Achashverosh that Haman fooled him. But she doesn't say it yet. And Achashverosh still doesn't pick it up totally. But we have to imagine that the seeds are starting to sprout. And Vayomer HaMelech Achashverosh, Vayomer L'Esther HaMalkah, that double Vayomer seems to indicate perhaps that we want to create now a Melech Malkah equality, or perhaps that, as Chazal say, first he wanted to speak through a middleman, then he spoke directly to her, or perhaps it means, it indicates tremendous rage and strength in his words, and he said, and boy did he say, Mihu zeve ezehu, which is, again, two ways of saying the same thing. Who is it, and who is it really? Who is the guy? Asher malauli bo lasot kein, who has filled his heart to do such a thing. Now, if you're Haman, you listen, you don't know what the queen is talking about. Some guy's out there being very nervy, trying to kill the queen. And by the way, if you're the king, you're doubly confused, because the whole time you thought that the queen and Haman were in on a racket to try to get you to this party and kill you in some way, or overthrow you. And now, suddenly, the queen is asking a defensive question, to be saved, to be spared. The king is, well, who is it who is threatening you? Vatomer Esther, Ish Tsar Ve'oyev, Haman Hara Hazeh. She points, we assume, and she says, an evil and man who's an enemy, Ish Tsar Ve'oyev, really an opposing enemy man, Haman hara hazeh. She points to Haman. Haman hara hazeh. And suddenly everything is confusion, except of course for Esther. Haman, who thought the Esther and the king liked her, suddenly finds Esther pointing a finger at him. Achashverosh, who thought perhaps Haman is a trusted advisor and perhaps Esther's in cahoots with him, suddenly finds it's Esther against Haman. Everything is in confusion. Chazal have an interesting observation here. They say that the introductory line, Ish Tsar Ve'oyev. At that point, Esther was prepared to point to Achashverosh. And then a malach came along, an angel came along, and in this particular scene, from Esther's entrance into the king's throne room a day before, through the end of this piece of the plot, Chazal have malachim everywhere, angels everywhere, angels propping Esther's face up, and angels knocking Haman over, and angels uprooting Achashverosh's trees all over the place. Which is the Chazal's way of putting the divine wrinkle into what appears to be daily coincidences, if you will, and pointing out that God is the player behind the curtain, as it were, in the Megillah. Why is it that she originally points to Achashverosh? Well, it's very simple. Achashverosh's name and his seal are on all the documents that say the Jews are to be killed. Ahasuerus does not have an out of saying, well, I didn't know, Haman lied to me. There's no such thing. Take a look for a moment at something that was pointed out by Rabbi Dr. Yonatan Grossman in a wonderful article he wrote about this. Take a look in Malachim Aleph Chafalef, 1 Kings chapter 21, the first half of the story. And in that story, King Achav, the king of Israel, is upset because his neighbor won't sell him his property. So his wife says, you don't worry about it, I'll take care of it. And she takes his seal and she forges documents, she writes documents in directing the local judges to hold a kangaroo court and hold this guy for treason and have him killed. And she comes back to Ahab and says, okay, you could take the field. Ahab knew nothing about it. All he did was let his wife take his seal. And then Eliyahu Hanavi is commanded by God to go to him and say to him, Haratzachta v'gam yarashta, famous words, you have murdered and you also are trying to inherit? How is Ahav a murderer? The answer is very simple. If your name is on the document, you're the murderer. You don't have an out of saying, I didn't know, I trusted the wrong person. There's no such thing. The buck stops here. And in the same way, Chazal are pointing out that Esther really was about to point to Ahasuerus, but the divine directive had her point to the person behind the plan, which is Haman. Haman harahazeh, v'haman niv'at v'nifrei ha-melech v'hamalkah. And Haman then was shocked and surprised in front of the king. You can imagine his emotions are now quite tumultuous. What does the king do? Well, the king does what he does every time he's got a problem, which is he doesn't deal with it. You go back to the first case with Vashti, when he gets enraged at Vashti. What does he do? He calls a meeting, asks advisors what to do. When they don't know what to do, they're kind of stuck until Mamukhan comes up with an idea. Ahasuerus at no point knows what to do. After he's recovers from the Vashti incident, it takes other courtiers to give him advice, and then he agrees with it. He likes it. Now the king is enraged. His trusted advisor is out to kill the queen, and of course by this time Esther has planted the seeds, so Ahasuerus believes it, and Haman doesn't deny it. And what does Ahasuerus do? He takes a walk. He goes outside to the garden. Now what happens while he's outside? V'haman omeid v'akesh al nafsho mester hamalka. Amad v'akesh al nafsho mester hamalka. Haman stood up to plea for his life from Esther. And we imagine here Esther, as we'll see in a moment, reclining on a divan at the party, and Haman standing over her, shaking, begging her, saying, please, 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 spare me, because he knows that the only person who could save his life, and ironically, irony of ironies, is Esther. The one Jew who he did not properly identify and who he was going to kill based on his plan is the one person who can save his life. Because Ahasuerus is not going to save his life. Nobody else can. The only person who could do it would be the queen, who would say, Ech ben Moichel, I'll forgive him, give him another chance, exile him, whatever it is. And of course, she's not about to do that. But what happens when he is standing over her, evidently trembling? And the king came back, got his fresh air, calmed down a little bit. And then Haman suddenly fell on the bed where Esther was. This has violent overtones, sexual overtones, has rape overtones, unclear what's happening. Whatever it is not good for anybody. And the king says, what, you want to even conquer my own queen in my own house? And by the way, this reflects for us that Ahasuerus' anger is not at the fact that Haman wanted to kill a people, and even perhaps that Haman wanted to kill this beautiful young woman, but it's that Haman wanted to kill his queen. And now he's going to take her here in the house. Perhaps it looks like Haman is jumping her to kill her. Unclear. But whatever it may be, that's where the king's main concern is, because he sees Haman now as a usurper. He thought beforehand that the Haman and Esther were in cahoots to kill him and take over. Now he sees that Haman is trying to perhaps kill both of them. Unclear. Whatever it is, Haman is finished. Hadavar yatza mipi ha-melech, ufnei Haman chafu. The word came out from the king, ufnei Haman chafu. This phrase is a very difficult phrase. I'll spend a couple minutes on it. First of all, back we had the similar word, chafu, back in Perek Vav. At the end of Perek Vav, when Haman returned home, he returned home avel v'chafui rosh. He was mourning and his head was covered. His head was covered as a sign of mourning, but his head was covered also because that was part of this outfit that he was wearing when he was walking Mordechai through the streets. But as the Targumim have it, the whole famous story about his daughter, that he covered his head out of a sign of mourning. This is a common custom in the Middle East. Was it practiced in Persia? Unclear. But it certainly did exist among many cultures, including our own, that during a time of mourning, the head would be covered. However, and as mentioned, of course, in the Sugya on Moed Katan, Atifat HaRosh. However, here it's a little bit more difficult. Ufnei Haman Chafu. Most of the translators render it that they covered the face of Haman. And the Ibn Ezra here notes, and I'm indebted to my student Noah Small for pointing this out to me, that the Ibn Ezra notes that it was the custom in Persia that when somebody was going to be executed, they would cover their face, minimize the disgrace, especially in the presence of the king. Others suggest that whereas Haman beforehand was ro'eh pnei ha-melech, now he could no longer see the face of the king, so they covered it. The problem with all of those approaches, and again, it is most of the translations, both in traditional and in modern, take ufnei Haman chafu as they covered the face of Haman. The problem is that there's no subject there. And if that were the case, it really should read, Vayichapu et pnei Haman. They covered the face of Haman. Here, the subject seems to be the face of Haman. Ufnei Haman, chafu. And remember, panim, face, in Hebrew is plural. And therefore, chafu, which is a plural verb, matches beautifully with pnei. And therefore, there are those who suggest that there may be a textual emendation to think about here, in which there's a resh that should be understood as there. As in, Ufnei Haman, chafru. And this is a word that we find throughout Tanakh as shame. Chafra halvana, for instance, Yeshayahu says, the moon is shame, the sun will be embarrassed when Hashem is the king over Tzion, etc. We may not need that, however. We may be able to say that Ufnei Haman chafu means his head was down. In other words, the king said it and Haman immediately put his face down. Nobody covered it, but he put his own face down, so it was somewhat covered. Out of disgrace. And there, the verb, the syntax, works properly, the word doesn't need to be played with, and the meaning remains appropriate. In any case, Haman is finished, Haman is covered up, and one of the difficulties with Ibn Ezra's approach is that Ibn Ezra suggests that it was the custom to when they were going to execute somebody to cover his face, but the execution of Haman has not yet been decreed. That's going to happen in the next pasuk. Right. So now one of the servants of the king who was hanging around there, Harvona, who was at the party, speaks up and he says, now notice how he says it. Oh, by the way, there's also a gibbet that Haman constructed for Mordechai who spoke good for the king. That same Mordechai that you honored today, Haman constructed a gallows for him, a gibbet for him. And it's in Haman's own house, which, by the way, itself is a point, because if you look at Ezra Parakeh, and we talked about this earlier in the podcast series, the punishment in the Persian Empire for treason against the king, for treason, for acting against the king, is to be impaled on a tree in your own property. Here, Haman has constructed a gibbet in his own backyard, and so therefore, this is a perfect opportunity. And, by the way, who did he construct it for? To hurt the king's one loyal friend, Mordechai. What a traitor this guy is. What does the king say? The king says, very simply, hang him on it. And, right, and for the second time in the Megillah, the king calms down. Haman has now been hanged. Now the king can finally calm down. But from what is he calming down? So one can argue that he's calming down from his upsetness at this party with Haman, but I think he's calming down from a lot more than that. Remember, the last time he calmed down was at the very beginning of chapter 2. From that point on, Esther enters the story, and Esther brings with her a certain amount of tension, of mystery, of who is she, which for Ahasuerus is a mixed blessing. It's kind of exciting, maybe titillating, but it's also frustrating, and for the paranoid Ahasuerus, that may be a real problem. Suddenly, everything has been resolved. He understands the parties, he understands who Esther is, he understands who Haman really is, he's got the whole picture. He realized he made a mistake in trusting Haman with his ring. Suddenly, everything is clear. And that is a reason to suddenly have all of the anger be come to rest. Chamat HaMelech Shachacha. So what we have seen over the course of this very short parak Yod, and not only a short parak, but a short parak with short psukim, and I'll explain in a minute why that's significant, is at the second party, whereas it starts out with same old, party, king, rest, suddenly everything comes together in the denouement of the main plot of the story, which is Haman's rise and fall. And now, of course, all that's left to do is the larger picture, but one that at this point should be fairly easy to deal with, which is to somehow respond properly to the terrible decrees that he sent out. And that is something that we will deal with in Parakhet. The reason I mentioned that the verses are small is if you look at the 8th chapter of Megillat Esther, it is not an overly long chapter. Tet is long, and that will probably take us a couple of podcasts. But if you take a look at Parakhet, you will see that the verses are relatively long. Parakhet has 17 psukim. However, Pasuk Tet in Parakhet is the longest pasuk in all of Tanakh. And we will get to that in our next podcast. In the meantime, everyone should have a wonderful day.